From Tribune Tower, WGN Radio presents A Conversation.
I want to make one thing perfectly clear.
A dialogue.
What are you prepared to do?
An astute debate.
Everything within the law.
And a peek behind the curtain of politics.
And then what are you prepared to do?
I think Chicago is not only the center of the country, I think it's the center of the world.
Don't tread on them.
Where did this statement come from?
This is the Sunday Spin. Your host is the Chicago Tribune's Rick Pearson.
Good Sunday morning, everyone. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune, and welcome to this week's edition of the Sunday Spin for Sunday, May the 22nd, 2016. This is our weekly review of what's happening in politics from Washington to Springfield, and as always, there's that stuff going on at City Hall. We'll take a look at what happened last week, and we'll try to give you a heads up on what to watch for in the days ahead. So, yes, it's time to grab that Sunday paper, grab the cup of coffee, and we'll do the politics today so you don't have to. Well, Dave, it's good to be back here on this Sunday morning after taking last Sunday off.
It's good to have you back, and once again, congratulations to the graduate and the family there. That's always great news.
Thank you very much. My youngest daughter, Kate, now a graduate of the University of Missouri. And a great trip down to Columbia, Missouri. What a beautiful campus. What a beautiful school.
Yeah.
And it is, you can really tell, it's so green down there. You know, I mean, it just everything is, the further south you go, it's just everything is so greened up. And I also have to tell you, there's nothing wrong with being in the land of $1.99 a gallon gasoline.
Is that what you paid?
That's what the price of gasoline was in Columbia, Missouri, yes.
Wow. That's great.
And even in right around the Metro East area on the Illinois side of the river across from St. Louis, it was $2.20. And it's like, well, wait till we get to Missouri because Missouri's always got the cheaper gas. It was $2.17 in St. Louis. So yeah. You didn't really save anything
right
there.
That's still a bargain.
Yes, yes. But, I mean, just a beautiful time and a great ceremony. Over 500 kids graduating from the journalism school. Just journalism.
Oh, my gosh.
The great J school at the University of Missouri. And all very proud graduates. And now on to the real world.
Yeah, right. Well, you will find out, either a high school teacher I had or a college professor said, now you will find out how little you know.
That's true, but, I mean, they do get a great education down there. And, you know, I went to Southern Illinois University at Edwardsville, and a smaller school, still 1,600-acre campus on the bluffs of the Mississippi, over the Mississippi River down in Edwardsville. Beautiful school. But, you know, not exactly known as one of your majors, you know. And you go down to University of Missouri, and, of course, they're in the SEC conference, and the J-School graduation was held in the women's volleyball arena. Okay. But it's a real arena. I mean, it's like you would swear it was like a, you know, it had the four-sided scoreboard with the video board on it. And it's like, yes, welcome to major college athletics here, folks. I mean, it's quite the thing. But, just a tremendous time. And I, of course, want to thank the great Amanda Vinicky from Illinois Public Radio and WUIS-FM in Springfield for filling in for me last week. And I heard the podcast. It was a great show, and I appreciate her filling in. And I'm sure, Dave, you didn't mind.
Not at all.
No, of course not.
Not at all. Not at all. And I think I speak for everyone.
Yeah, I'm sure you do. I'm sure you do. But, yeah, Amanda is great. And, in fact, Dave, I didn't get a chance to tell you this, but you will be hearing from Amanda next week.
Really?
Because she and I will be co-hosting the Sunday Spin as the Sunday Spin goes on the road to Springfield, Illinois next Sunday.
Okay, I knew you were doing a road show at some point here.
Yes, the May 29th show, as we approached the, I want to say it's the end of session deadline for the never-ending session of the Illinois General Assembly, but of course, May 31st is the traditional end of session deadline, and we'll be live on the air from the basement, the basement of the Illinois State Capitol, which is where the press room is down there. And
that is, of course, if the elevator works properly to get to the basement of the, because when we were there a couple of weeks ago, we waited forever. And then we went up a floor.
Well, they didn't pay the bill.
Oh, that's okay.
There's no money to pay the bill for the elevator maintenance. Well, there's the staircase to, you can go down.
Well, that's true, but I've got a bad foot.
Is that all?
I've got a bad foot.
Well, that's probably the lead foot from all the driving that you've been doing lately.
Maybe part of it, yeah. But you were also in another road show here earlier in the week.
Well,
you just got back
just
last
got
night.
Back, yes, just got back from beautiful downtown Peoria, Illinois, where the Peoria Civic Center was the home of the every four-year Illinois Republican State Convention. And we'll be talking more about that in the show. I'll have former state Republican chairman Pat Brady will be joining us at 7:30 to talk about that. But, you know, never a dull moment when it comes to a gathering of politicians. And you had all of these delegates from all across the state. And it was actually the first time for many of those Donald Trump presidential nominating delegates to actually meet face-to-face. They were down in Peoria, and I had a story in the Tribune on Friday, and you can still find it online, kind of talking about who these people are, because for the most part, Dave, these are people who are, they don't, other than like a handful, they've never run for office, they've never, other than voting, that's really the most active they've ever been.
So this is all new to them.
It's all very new to them, and frankly, for a lot of them, these were the 39 that got elected on March 15th. A lot of them didn't know that they were supposed to pay their own way to Cleveland.
Oh.
and the cost.
Well, they could just send the bill to Donald.
Well, apparently, it turns out that representatives of the Trump campaign said that indeed they will be trying to help out with some aspects of the costs of attending the convention. And truly, it is not a cheap venture. It's $3,000 to $5,000 a person.
Yeah, well, all told with expenses. And I would imagine this would be the case in all the other states as well, not just Illinois.
No, absolutely, absolutely. And then there's even like a $600 Illinois delegation fee to kind of cover, you know, to some of the things like having a breakfast, a delegation breakfast, and some of the social events that go on. It's not a cheap affair. And yeah, you look at all of those other state delegations and everything else. And yeah, Cleveland's going to be very interesting in July.
To say the least.
Yes, to put it mildly.
To say the least.
Not exactly sure what to expect there, but yes, and I will be attending that event as well. So all kinds of interesting things going on, and as I said, we'll be reporting from Springfield with the latest on what's going on with the legislature, if anything is going to be going on with the legislature. And I know right now already that next week we'll be speaking with Illinois House Republican Leader Jim Durkin has agreed to be on the show. And we will try to find some folks from the Democratic supermajority to represent their side as well. So I think it'll be an interesting show, but we've got a great show today. Joining me after Dave's 7:30 news update, as I said, is Pat Brady, who was at the state Republican convention in Peoria. After the 8 o'clock news from Dave, we'll be speaking to two suburban mayors, Jerry Bennett of Palos Hills and Downers Grove Mayor Martin Tully, and they'll be here to talk about fears that that state budget impasse will once again impact dollars that are owed to municipalities. And then after the 8:30 news update, we'll be joined by Democratic State Senator Andy Menar of Bunker Hill in Macoupin County. Senator Menar was on the show recently talking about his efforts to change the state school aid formula. And, you know, this is really an important topic, and it's still being much talked about, some concerns about whether there will be state funding for schools that, if it's not there, you know, they may not, some of them may not open in the fall. So with the end of session getting near, I wanted him to come back on the show to talk about that. Well, Dave's here to keep us up on all the news. Producer Jasmine is fielding your phone calls. 312-981-7200 is our phone number. You can also text us at that number, 312-981-7200. We're on Facebook at facebook.com/thesundayspin. Twitter as well, @SundaySpin. And engineer Bob is sad to see me back, since things always seem to run more smoothly when Amanda is here in the Allstate Showcase studio. Also, don't forget, you can find all of our shows on WGNRadio.com. You can also get our podcast at iTunes. Just search for my name, Rick Pearson. Well, when we come back, we'll take our weekly spin through national politics, but right now we're going to take a break. You're listening to The Sunday Spin on WGN. Good Sunday morning, everyone. I'm Rick Pearson here in the Allstate Showcase studio on this beautiful, bright Sunday morning on the Mag Mile in downtown Chicago. It's time for our weekly spin through national politics. Always something going on. Another primary election day last week, another split on the Democratic side. Hillary Clinton appearing to narrowly win Kentucky while Bernie Sanders capturing Oregon. Clinton was in the Chicago area last week for fundraisers, and while she was here, she talked to CNN about that crash of an Egyptian passenger jet, and she said the issue of terrorism is why she should be president.
It once again shines a very bright light on the threats that we face from organized terror groups. ISIS, of course, but then there are other networks of terrorists that have to be hunted down and defeated. And I think it reinforces the need for American leadership, for the kind of smart, steady leadership that only America can provide in working with our allies, our partners, our friends in Europe, the Middle East, and elsewhere, because we have to have a concerted effort that brings to bear both domestic resources, sharing of intelligence, take a hard look at airport security one more time. Whatever needs to be done must be done. The world depends upon air travel. We can't allow it to be interrupted or people be intimidated. And to continue to take the fight, although it needs to be even more intensified, against ISIS from where it is running its operations in Syria and Iraq.
Now, despite her lead in Democratic nominating delegates, Bernie Sanders isn't going away, and he's making a big push for California. That's, of course, the big treasure trove of delegates on June 7th. Sanders' campaign manager, Jeff Weaver, told Chris Matthews on MSNBC's Hardball why getting more delegates is important.
I think if you look at the issues that Bernie Sanders has been talking about and continues to talk about on the campaign trail, you know, unlike Donald Trump, who spends his time hurling insults, Bernie Sanders actually gives long speeches about substantive issues, things like raising the minimum wage to $15, things like universal health care through a single-payer system, dealing with a corrupt campaign finance system, making sure that all the new wealth and income in this country stops going to the people at the very top, creating a new trade policy that benefits working-class people and not just the people on Wall Street. I mean, these are the types of issues that Bernie Sanders has been fighting for this whole campaign.
Now, as for Hillary Clinton, her supporting super PAC has made it clear that it intends to go after presumptive Republican nominee Donald Trump over the candidate's treatment of women. Here's one of two new ads that the Clinton super PAC is running in Ohio, Florida, Nevada, and Virginia.
Nobody respects women more than Donald Trump, that I can tell you.
I'm not supporting.
Would you cut off funding
of Planned Parenthood? Yes, I would.
You know, you could see there was blood coming out of her eyes, blood coming out of her wherever.
Do you believe in punishment for abortion, yes or no, as a principle?
The answer is that there has to be some form of punishment.
For the woman?
Yeah, there has to be some form.
Priorities USA Action is responsible for the content of this advertising.
But you got Donald Trump seeking to turn the tables on Hillary Clinton using that. Speaking to Fox News' Sean Hannity, Trump contended the New York Times did a major hit job on him when it wrote an article about the way that he associated and dealt with women. And the way Trump intends to go after Hillary Clinton is by going after Bill Clinton. Here's Donald Trump speaking with Sean Hannity.
I looked at the New York Times. Are they going to interview Juanita Broderick? Are they going to interview Paula Jones? Are they going to interview Kathleen Willey? In one case, it's about exposure. In another case, it's about groping and fondling and touching against a woman's will.
And rape.
And rape.
That's Donald Trump bringing up the word rape in association with Bill Clinton. Additionally, the presumptive Republican nominee went on a Fox Network special with Megyn Kelly. Now, you remember what Donald Trump said about Megyn Kelly. Well, Trump said to Megyn Kelly that he has to act the way he does in order to win.
Absolutely. I could have done certain things differently. I could have maybe used different language in a couple of instances. But overall, I have to be very happy with the outcome. And I think if I didn't conduct myself in the way I've done it, I don't think I would have been successful, actually. If I were soft, if I were, you know, presidential, okay, presidential. It's, in a way, it's a bad word because there's nothing wrong with being presidential. But if I would not have fought back the way I fought back, I don't think I would have been successful.
So there you have it. There's nothing wrong with being presidential. It's just if you're acting presidential, you can't be successful to run for president of the United States. So that's Donald Trump in his conversation with Megyn Kelly. Well, coming up after the 7:30 news is Pat Brady, former state Republican chairman, and we'll be talking about the two-day Republican state convention held in Peoria that wrapped up yesterday. Right now, though, we're going to take a quick break. You're listening to The Sunday Spin on WGN. Welcome back to The Sunday Spin. Once again, just want to recap what's ahead in the show this morning. Pat Brady, state Republican chairman, will be talking about the state Republican convention in Peoria. That's at 7:30. After the 8 o'clock news, I'll have a couple of suburban mayors talking about their fears about the state's budget impasse and the effect that that could have on funding municipal government. That'll be Palos Hills Mayor Jerry Bennett, along with Downers Grove Mayor Martin Tully. And then after the 8:30 news, we'll be speaking with State Senator Andy Menar, a Democrat from downstate Bunker Hill. Senator Menar has been on the show recently and is at the forefront of efforts to try to change the way the state distributes state money to local school districts. And this is becoming a very hot topic as we approach the scheduled end of the legislative session, because there are some concerns that in a continued budget stalemate, unlike last year, when schools did receive funding, that this year they may not get funding. And what would that mean as far as schools opening in the fall? Not to mention the great serious financial problems that are facing the Chicago public schools as well. So that's all coming up on the Sunday Spin.
Now back to the Tribune's Rick Pearson. It's the Sunday Spin on 720 WGN.
Good Sunday morning, everyone. Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune, and this is your Sunday Spin on this beautiful Sunday morning in downtown Chicago. I'm here in the Allstate Showcase studio, and joining me on the phone is Pat Brady, the former state Republican chairman, and now with Next Generation Public Strategies. Pat, thanks for getting up with me this morning.
No problem. Did you get back all right from Peoria?
Well, if you can hear me on the radio, what do you think?
You know, it can be a long trip, though.
Yeah, well, it was a long 2 days, that's for sure. Pat, I wanted to talk about, first of all, you know, obviously yesterday is the floor session of the nearly 1,000 delegates from across the state, all of the speeches, all the floor speeches, and, of course, kind of this basic theme work of an effort by Republicans to show unity despite divisions, divisions ideologically based, divisions geographically based, divisions over the presidential candidate. And I thought it was very interesting. And of course, you know, basically Republicans trying to build off the theme of having Governor Bruce Rauner elected and now trying to translate that into victories in November, particularly in the legislative races, to try to erode the Democratic supermajority in the House and Senate. But that having been said, I thought it was very interesting and most notable that in a 20-minute speech to the delegates, the governor said he supports the Republican ticket from top to bottom and never mentioned the name of the presumptive Republican presidential nominee, Donald Trump.
Yeah, interesting. If you see the recent polling, he does do well downstate, which I think is good for Republicans in the House and Senate, where we're trying to win races because that'll bring people on our way down there. where we have pickup opportunities. But north of I-80, and we talked about this during the primary, we get creamed with Donald Trump gets creamed in the polling. The suburban, particularly suburban women, just do not like him.
Well, it's kind of interesting. There's a new ABC News Washington Post poll that's out this morning, and it shows that the race between both Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton, a virtual dead heat, but it's Trump 46, Hillary Clinton 44%. But when you look at people, how they, you know, the positivity rating or negativity rating, this is like the worst that the Washington Post ABC poll has ever found. Nearly 6 in 10 registered voters say they have negative impressions of both major candidates. It's like 57% for each of them.
For a worst ever in the history of since they've been doing polling. These are the two most unpopular candidates we've ever had. And it was interesting to listen to your clip of Secretary Clinton talking about ISIS and terrorism and what we need to do. I mean, I agree with actually what she was saying, but it's like she acts like she wasn't there in the U.S. Senate or a Secretary of State, and she's just starting new. So I think a lot of Republicans and Democrats don't care for her too much, and the same on the Republican side. People just are not excited about Trump. Beyond the personality quirks, is the I don't think, and I think a lot of people feel this way. He doesn't necessarily represent Republican principles.
And I mean, just as disclosure warrants, that you were elected as a John Kasich delegate for the National Nominating Convention in Cleveland. But when you look at the numbers and the negativity, and obviously this is a poll that's now, this, you know, this is a end of May poll, and we're still a long way to go till November, and numbers fluctuate and those kinds of things. But, you know, when you look at the fact, and you still have Hillary Clinton ostensibly in a fight with Bernie Sanders, and Sanders trying to woo those superdelegates who are really what are pushing Hillary Clinton over the top when it comes to the nomination on the Democratic side. So she's still somewhat in a, you know, contested contest. But you look at those negativity ratings on both sides. What does that mean for turnout? I mean, we saw in the primary, you know, competitive races on both sides boosted turnout, and Republican turnout was big. But when you see that negativity, does that just mean an overall general election kind of a eh?
Yeah, I hope not, because it's bad for democracy. But from a Republican perspective, I saw a couple polls this morning that Trump at the top of the ticket actually puts two very reliable Republican states, Georgia and Arizona, in play for the Democrats. And John McCain, a guy that I've admired for years, is running for U.S. Senate in Arizona, and I think he's got a race on his hands because of what you're talking about. People either don't show up or don't support the nominee on the Republican side. So I think it could have a big impact. But, you know, Secretary Clinton is very unpopular with her, with the Democrats, too. So I hope it's not, but it looks like it could be a super low turnout race unless they can message this to just forget the top of the ticket and concentrate down ticket. And we have important races in Illinois, including Senator Kirk and some downstate House seats we need to pick up. So I hope it's not that way, but conventional wisdom would tell you it might be a low turnout event.
Well, and it seems, you know, particularly in these contests where you have Republican Senate races up, and you look at, for example, John McCain, and here's a guy very early on in Trump's candidacy, when Trump made the comment about that he didn't consider John McCain to be a war hero because he got shot down, and yet you still have McCain, I'm going to support the nominee, and I guess it's how do you it's this kind of parsing that's going on. It's almost like it's the same with, frankly, the governor. He's going to support the ticket, but he's not going to endorse Donald Trump. I mean, it's just this kind of parsing that's going on here, reflecting, you know, the fears of what Donald Trump ostensibly could bring in some of these critical Republican races, including here in Illinois with Mark Kirk.
Yeah, well, you know, Senator McCain has a big Hispanic constituency, and Donald Trump, I think 8 in 10 disapprove of him. So he really has to walk a fine line between supporting being a good Republican or being a good conservative and supporting the nominee and trying to keep that base he needs to win. I think in Illinois it's a little less acute just because we're not in play. Hillary Clinton's going to win Illinois in the presidential by a long shot. So we have to concentrate on the down ticket races. And if the U.S. Senate can be considered down ticket, but Mark's got a big race. And again, those downstate House seats that we're concentrated on and a couple of Senate seats. So it is difficult, but you got to do what you got to do. And just the hand the Republicans have been dealt. I think it does say more to our nominating process, which needs badly to be reformed and likely will be after this cycle.
How do you see those changes? What changes would you like to see?
I'd like to see regional primaries. And we had a blast in Iowa, and I know you've been going over there for years in New Hampshire, but those two primaries that get so much attention don't reflect, I don't think, all the Republican Party. I think we need to have a regional primaries. That's just, there are many reforms, but I've always liked the idea of a regional primaries.
Well, and it seems, I don't know why, but it just seems how things have changed. Because I always appreciated Iowa as a state for people to the retail aspect, the retail campaigning aspect of it, where people actually got a chance to see these people up close, ask questions in the coffee shops, that kind of thing. But then when you look at Donald Trump, it's, bringing the 757 into the airport hangar, having a huge rally, and then taking off again. And it kind of, it's completely different from how the Iowa process and New Hampshire process, to some extent, was supposed to work.
Yeah, and he's adopting the same strategy in the general election. As Mitch said publicly, that he's not impressed with the database the Republicans have and what the RNC has spent years and millions of donor dollars putting together. He's going to do that fly-around campaign again. And maybe it's just a reflection of his celebrity status, his years of being on The Apprentice, and the fact that even from 4 years ago, everybody's a lot more wired into social media. So maybe the retail site that you and I like so much, maybe it's not as relevant anymore, and it is a different kind of campaign. You have to give him credit for at least recognizing that you can at least win a primary doing that. And I'm not sure if that's going to work in the general election because you really want to identify your voters and get them out. But that seems to be the path he's taking.
Well, I almost wonder if social media is now the new form of retail campaigning.
I think it is. I mean, we're all wired into it, people that pay a lot of attention to this. And I know particularly the younger generation, I got to believe that's how Bernie Sanders gets the crowds he gets, all the young people. It probably has changed. I'm not sure if anybody – I think Trump may have grabbed lightning in the bottle just once. He had, the perfect storm of celebrity status and the understanding of social media. But when you see, after this airline disaster of last week, when Donald Trump, before anybody knows what actually happened, tweets out, this is terrorism, we need to get tough on terrorism, using social media for political gain, not actually thinking it through before he shoots it out, that can do a lot of damage.
And the fact that you're limited to 140 characters, there's not a lot of room for nuance. Everything is black or white.
Yeah, and I think in a certain level, texting, tweeting is not a great way to communicate at all because you don't hear the voice, and sometimes can be taken the wrong way. And it is. It's 140 characters. That's not enough, particularly when you're dealing with foreign policy and national security. A lot of articles today about some of the comments Trump has made about nuclear weapons. He wants to give Japan nuclear weapons, and Asia is a mess right now. And they are actually talking about Japan, about getting nuclear weapons. I mean, that's an unbelievable development in U.S. foreign policy.
Especially as the president is on his way to Vietnam and Hanoi, and also a stop in Hiroshima. We're speaking with Pat Brady, former state Republican chairman with Next Generation Public Strategies. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin. Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson here in the Allstate Showcase studio. On the phone, Pat Brady, former state Republican chairman, now with Next Generation Public Strategies. We're talking about Donald Trump. We're talking about the Illinois State Republican Convention. Right before the break, we were talking about, that aspect of social media kind of maybe becoming the new retailing of politics. And Pat, I wanted to note this story I had overlooked last week, that this is a independent congressional candidate in Virginia who posted on his Facebook page, basically his web browser, and he was trying to show his Facebook page. And some people noted that some of the open tabs in his web browser included two porn sites.
That's a bad move by the campaign, I think.
Yeah, you think. Well, except what was worse is when his explanation aired on WUSA TV, he said that he had been told that his computer had a virus, and when he took it in to get the virus cleaned, the folks told him that porn sites can lead to web viruses. So he said that when this screenshot was taken, he was just trying to see whether their theory about viruses was true. How's that for an explanation?
That's an interesting explanation. He probably would have just been better off admitting that he looked at the porn sites and moved on.
Yeah, that's your story. I'm sticking to it. It just gets stranger and stranger out there. Well, Pat, we've got a call from Ron. Ron, as always, welcome to the Sunday Spin.
Good morning, Rick. Welcome back, and congratulations to you and your family on the graduation. Mr. Brady, I have a question. I'm going to make reference. I got this information from your colleague, Rick Eric Zorn. You talked about Donald Trump's numbers, but according to this article, Governor Rauner's numbers are down even compared with 6 months ago. They're down to 34% approval rate. So I don't know. He may have done Donald Trump a favor by not mentioning his name. So I want to ask you, what is your concern overall? And we know a lot of it has to do with the budget impasse. But right now, what is your concern about the governor helping some of these Republican candidates in the upcoming election? Thanks, Rick.
Sure, Ron.
Yeah, no, I have no concern. In fact, at this point in his governorship, I thought Governor Rauner would be about 20%, just given the fact that he's making some very difficult decisions in a state that's been mismanaged for a long, long time. And he's trying to reform the state, and reform and change is difficult, and it can be painful. But the reality is he was handed the state billions of dollars out of whack from a budget deficit perspective, and he's trying to clean it up. On the positive side, too, Governor Rauner has done more to re-establish the Republican Party infrastructure, recruiting candidates, raising money throughout the state than any time in my lifetime. So I feel great about what he's done. He's just doing very difficult things right now. And if you really want to do a comparison, Speaker Madigan, I think, comes in about 18% approval rating. So not great numbers for either of them, but as far as Governor Rauner, I'm not the least bit concerned because he's doing exactly what he said he was going to do when he ran.
Well, indeed, in the story that is in today's edition of the Tribune that I wrote from Peoria, the thing I was struck by was, obviously it's a presidential year. There's the big Senate race with Mark Kirk seeking re-election against Tammy Duckworth, but Rauner gave particular focus to the legislative. And obviously, yes, the budget impasse is still a story, that kind of thing. But as the governor even said, this impasse isn't about the budget, it's about the future of the state of Illinois. And he promised to provide and bring in resources for the biggest ground game on behalf of political candidates, obviously on his side, Republican candidates, that the state has ever seen. And that is a different kind of factor to see, when you look back to just this March 15th primary, and you had that Ken Duncan primary race that Juliana Stratton beat Ken Duncan, but you had Rauner allied forces in that one, and you were talking about a $6 million primary race. You're looking at the prospects of significant funding, particularly on the Republican side, in some of these legislative races.
Yeah, and this is where if you talk to the experienced Democrat strategists or political operatives, they'll tell you the Trump effect downstate is going to hurt them, the Democrats, and help us in some of these races we think we can pick up. And he has done a great deal to raise a lot of money. And it's nice even, Rick, to see at the convention. I've been going to these things for a long time like you have. There's a whole new young generation of political operatives that the Republicans just haven't had in the last 10 years that are down there working these campaigns. So give the Democrats and the Speaker credit. They know how to run campaigns. You know how rigorous this program is for his members. And I think now you're seeing that kind of discipline and structure and smart thinking
from the Republicans and give Governor Rauner credit for that because he's in charge of it.
One of the things, and you're very familiar with this issue, and this was the issue involving the state Republican platform, and you were a member of the platform committee, and one of the issues with the platform was the issue of basically striking the definition of marriage of being between one man and one woman, and kind of an acknowledgement that there are also non-traditional families and that deserve, you know, dignity and respect. That language went to a floor vote. 80% of the delegates voted that new language down and went back to the 2012 language of that old definition. But part of the rationale came from three Republican members of the legislature who said, and largely for downstate, that they needed that marriage definition, even though it's, you know, for many Republicans and many in the public, that issue's over. But they said they needed that definition, particularly to attract, recruit, and campaign for downstate Republican candidates.
Yeah, it's interesting. And as you know, this state is so diverse on some of these issues, guns and some of the social issues. It's hard to keep the coalition together. And I sat in that meeting, and as you did, for 6 hours and heard what the downstaters had to say about what they felt about the change. And there wasn't really much talk of the political consideration, very little, less than I wanted, because we are a political party and our main aim is to get our candidates elected. So I don't know why we neglect to have a political discussion. But towards the end, when they actually started talking politics, that was what they said, that it would really hurt them downstate.
I have to wonder, in talking to some people, about whether, does it even make sense to have a platform anymore? You know, maybe statement of principles, maybe, but a party state party platform, is it really relevant? And frankly, I've never heard a party platform brought up in a political campaign.
No, the only time a party platform gets brought up is when you're trying to beat somebody over the head with it during a primary.
Right.
I don't think Ohio, one of the most effective Republican political organizations, from a Republican perspective, I don't think they have a platform. I think it's just a statement of principles. I agree completely. I'd get rid of the platform because a lot of our candidates, and it says in the preamble, like there's somewhere in the language that we welcome a diversity of opinions. You don't have to agree with all of this to be a Republican. But again, people just use it as a weapon in the primary to hurt their opponents.
Yeah, I mean, to me, it's like the only stories that ever come out of these conventions involve some kind of divisive thing that's about putting the platform together, but then, you know, again, who runs on the platform? So,
well, it's kind of like you were in the meeting, and it's not apples to apples comparison, but the question came up is, who has read Roe v. Wade? You know, the one we're talking about,
right?
Overruling. There were three people there that actually read it, so the same can be said. I bet you 80% of Republicans have never read the platform. So peacefulness is questionable at best.
Well, that's Pat Brady, former state Republican chairman, now with Next Generation Public Strategies. Pat, thanks very much for joining me this morning.
Always fun, Rick. Take care. See ya.
You're listening to The Sunday Spin on WGN. Up ahead on The Sunday Spin, we'll be speaking with Palos Hills Mayor Jerry Bennett and Downers Grove Mayor Martin Tully about their concerns about the state's budget impasse and the effect that that could have once again on local municipalities.
This is The Sunday Spin on 720 WGN. Once again, here's Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune.
Good Sunday morning, everyone. This is your Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune, here in the Allstate Showcase studio overlooking a gloriously sunny Mi-Mag Mile. It's just a beautiful day out there today. Please be sure to go out and enjoy it. It's great to be back. As everybody knows, last week I was down at the University of Missouri to see my youngest daughter, Kate, graduate. A lot of graduations at higher education institutions last week, including at Rutgers University, and that's where President Obama delivered the keynote address. And in that address, he made some references to the presumptive Republican presidential nominee, Donald Trump, but like a lot of people, it seems like Republicans are referring to him as he who shall not be named. But here are some of those comments from the president.
The world is more interconnected than ever before, and it's becoming more connected every day. Building walls won't change that. Isolating or disparaging Muslims, suggesting that they should be treated differently when it comes to entering this country, That is not just a betrayal of our values. That's not just a betrayal of who we are. It would alienate the very communities at home and abroad who are our most important partners in the fight against violent extremism. Suggesting that we can build an endless wall along our borders and blame our challenges on immigrants, that doesn't just run counter to our history as the world's melting pot. It contradicts the evidence that our growth and our innovation and our dynamism has always been spurred by our ability to attract strivers from every corner of the globe. That's how we became America. Why would we want to stop it now? So, class of 2016, let me be as clear as I can be. In politics and in life, ignorance is not a virtue.
That's President Obama speaking at Rutgers commencement address last Sunday. Well, joining me now here in the Allstate Showcase studio is Palos Hills Mayor Jerry Bennett. Mayor Bennett is president of the Southwest Conference of Mayors as well as chairman of CMAP, the Chicago Metropolitan Agency for Planning. Also on the phone, Downers Grove Mayor Martin Tully. And Mayor Tully is the immediate past president of the DuPage Mayors and Managers Conference. Mayors, thank you very much for joining me this morning.
Thanks. Good morning, Rick.
Thank you, Rick. Good morning to you.
Good morning. The reason I wanted to have both of you on the show is to talk about the ongoing, ever-present budget impasse in Springfield, and with particularly the concern of how it affects municipalities. And we saw this take place in the previous budget making, where money that would be flowing through to municipalities was held up in this. Finally, some of the money was released, particularly over concerns of things like how we're going to make sure there's salt on the roads in the wintertime, that kind of thing. And now we're kind of back in that same situation again. And, you know, Mayor Tully, let's start with you. I mean, what's going on here?
Well, what's going on here is what I consider to be a situation of municipalities being under siege. We're getting hit from every direction, and the budget crisis is only part of it. If you also look at some of the legislation that has been proposed, and we've talked before about suggestions about eliminating or reducing the municipal share of the state income tax, which is known as LGDF. But more recently, Rick, the withheld local revenues that we've experienced, and yes, they were finally released after extraordinary action, but we're going to face that same crisis again where funds such as the our share of the use tax or sales tax, motor fuel tax funds, and for other communities, other things such as gaming revenue were being withheld and not coming to communities. And for each community, that can be a substantial amount of money. We don't receive all of those different revenue streams, but just for the two that my town does, Downers Grove, that can amount to almost $1 million last year.
And that's not money that's easily made up.
No, it's not easily made up at all. Having to cut $1 million out of your budget, particularly coming on the heels of what most municipalities did in the years following the Great Recession, 09, 08, they already made a lot of cuts. So there's no low-hanging fruit. There's no fat to trim in many of our towns. And I know we'll talk about it in a moment. On top of that, we have our continuing annual obligations, which only go in one direction with respect to funding, increased funding of public safety employee pension funds.
And Mayor Tully brought up, Mayor Bennett, my favorite term. I think I'm going to make sure everybody learns what LGDF stands for in this, because, you know, it always seems like this is a ripe target. And even though I can't say that I've heard a lot about LGDF, that's the local government share of the state income tax, that always seems to be a ripe target. Although I can't say I'm hearing a lot about that right now, and as you know, whatever progress is being made incrementally on trying to come up with a budget, Mayor Bennett, I don't know if you're hearing something different.
No, right now the temperament has been cooled a little bit, but LDGF has been really under attack, not only under this administration, but even in the Quinn administration. It seems when every time the state gets into a budget crisis, the first thing they look to is local government as the mayor indicated, low-hanging fruit, but it's not low-hanging fruit. The state share of the income tax is critical for a lot of municipalities. It may represent anywhere from 15 to 30% of their operating budget. So an attack on that money really creates a crisis for local government if, in fact, we lost that money.
But right now what we're looking at is things like as Mayor Tully said, things like these kind of pass-through revenues of a different scale, like 911 surcharge money, motor fuel tax receipts, sales tax, those kinds of things that, I mean, really the state doesn't do anything except they process the money and turn around and supposed to give it to you, except it has to be appropriated.
Correct. That's been a problem over certainly this last year, the first time ever that I can ever remember that because of the impasse of the state budget, monies were frozen everywhere. And for us, the continuing appropriations of that money, those are monies strictly collected by the state, put into a fund and then transferred to local government. It has nothing to do with the operating budget
of
the
state
of Illinois. Right, correct.
And it's not money that they can touch to use to plug a hole in the state budget.
They're not supposed to. But as that topic becomes now, should it be, that's what worries us going down the road, whether or not tapping into those funds or taking those funds away from local government becomes an issue for us.
So, Mayor Tully, is that something you're hearing, that's part of these talks that some of these budgeteer groups are talking about?
Well, of course, the concern is that every time the Illinois General Assembly is in session, municipalities...
Nobody's wallet is safe when the legislature's in session.
You know the old joke, and unfortunately, it's not a joke anymore. It seems to be a constant threat. And that's right. I mean, these are pass-through revenues that are just supposed to be collected by the state and then allocated to municipalities in their respective shares. And it's not that the state necessarily takes them, although that's always a threat. With the stroke of a pen, that can be changed. But the failure to appropriate these funds creates a real issue, because it isn't as though the money is necessarily set aside and we just have to wait to receive it. If the appropriation doesn't take place, we may not get it all. And last year there was some scrambling to make that happen, but there's always the possibility that the appropriation doesn't take place. And the question is that money that might be permanently lost in municipalities? And as you point out, that's a big hit.
That's Mayor Martin Tully from Downers Grove. We've also got Palos Hills Mayor Jerry Bennett. We're talking about the budget impasse and the effect on municipal governments. You're listening to The Sunday Spin on WGN. is our phone number. I'm Rick Pearson, and this is your Sunday Spin. And joining me here on the show are Mayors Jerry Bennett of Palos Hills and Martin Tully of Downers Grove. We're talking about the state budget impasse and its effect on municipal local government budgets. And, there was a bit of a bullet dodging for last year, but now we're looking ahead again about, despite what the governor says is great optimism, that there'll be a grand bargain. I'm sorry, I've been doing this about 30 years. I'm the pessimist. I'm the dark cloud. But, you know, Mayor Tully, so there's an effort to try to have a continuing appropriation, which, I mean, just explain what that is and how that would help all of you.
Well, the problem is that, as was pointed out earlier, last year we had the issue of the lack of a state budget appropriation. The pass-through funds we've been talking about, use tax, video gaming, motor fuel tax, 911 surcharge, et cetera, were not being distributed. And absent the solution that was arrived at, which municipalities were all thankful for, to release those funds, we're going to face the same problem again every year. And right now we're facing that same July 1st deadline for the fiscal 2017 budget. If legislation isn't passed in time to release those funds, or there aren't, as you say, continuing appropriations passed, we could be facing this problem every year. And given the shifting political environment, that just creates a huge uncertainty with respect to our organizations that are responsible for providing the services that people interface with most commonly every single day. A continuing appropriation would relieve that uncertainty and allow for these funds to go to their intended use, which is providing much-needed revenue to support these much-needed daily services that we owe our constituents.
And certainly, Mayor Bennett, that, I mean, for budgeted purposes, for municipal budgets, but also along with this is this all of this talk in the legislature, and it's part of the governor's what he calls his turnaround agenda, is the issue of a property tax freeze. And so you have, you know, that being thrown at you at the same time of you've got these budget, you know, where you're caught up in the budget impasse as well. And, you know, a property tax freeze, you know, it sounds great, but it, you know, there is local control issues here.
Certainly, Rick. I mean, the talk of property tax freeze is great theater. It's great political theater. But when you think about it, property taxes have, number one, nothing to do with the state of Illinois operating budget. It's all local control. Property taxes, for the most part, certainly in metropolitan Chicago and possibly outside downstate, represent 70% of that money goes to local schools.
So on
if not more,
the property tax bill.
So on one hand, if you have the state of Illinois who is not funding schools at their proper level and now frees them at a local level, they are really going to be caught in a box. Local government for us, our municipality, I mean, we've been fortunate over the years. We only take in about 5% of that property tax bill, which is hardly anything to deliver all the services that we do. But also, we're a non-home rule community, and we have been under property tax cap since 1996. So for the general public, that means that for the most part, it's been a cost of living increase each year. It's not been any great rise in local property taxes. So that's minuscule.
And there's been no great inflationary increases. I mean, and plus, let's face it, you're all under the political dynamic of, you know, everybody, the property tax is like the third rail, and to raise property taxes is not an easy thing to do, you know, beyond that kind of cost of living type adjustment.
Correct, but even for the portion that we do collect, the 5% in payless sales, a good portion of that, a significant portion of that, in fact, a third of that goes to pay for our downstate police and fire pension requirements. Again, another state mandate. So if you take away the opportunity to fund what you're supposed to do through the levy, and now they freeze it all together, again, that makes local governments rely on drawing down other revenues that come into our general funds, whether, in fact, it is state income tax or state sales tax, and it puts us, again, in jeopardy as to how we operate going forward. So a property tax freeze really is meaningless other than good political theater for those who are proposing it. But it can be a dangerous precedent. And in fact, when you think about it, if the state of Illinois had funded local schools at a 50% rate, which was a goal years ago, and it's dwindled ever since, you wouldn't have large property tax increases. The Metropolitan Mayor's Caucus, almost 10 years ago, when there was talk about a state income tax increase taking place, we came up with a formula on a dollar-for-dollar basis that the new state income tax, when now distributed back to local schools, would be a dollar-for-dollar. In other words, for every dollar they got, they would reduce their property tax by that same dollar. In other words, to get the equity back or the balance back of 50% funding by the state and 50% local. That's why property taxes have gone up, because the state of Illinois has not properly funded education at that level.
And we'll be talking about that in the next half hour of the program with State Senator Andy Menar about all those kinds of things, about the school aid formula and a property tax shift, income tax, property tax shift, those kinds of things. Mayor Tully, I was wondering your thoughts about this whole issue of, you know, we hear it, and I think the House has voted 18 times on it, about a property tax freeze.
I agree with Mayor Bennett completely, as with most mayors on this point. Whether you're a home rule community like Downers Grove is, or you're a non-home rule community, this is something that sounds great in theory, but it really doesn't address the issue. Number one, a property tax freeze limits the local control of municipalities who, again, deliver these basic services and can't distinguish between whether you're a Democrat or Republican when deciding to plow your street. It doesn't work that way. We have to deliver our services. And a property tax freeze, it erodes our local control and doesn't do anything to actually reduce the state's spending. So it sounds good, but it doesn't do anything to reduce the state's spending. All it does is erode our local control, which I want to add, in addition to having the 1-2 punch effect of eliminating our ability to fund something that we are then told by the state we have to fund, public safety employee pensions, which in my community last year, for example, we were mandated to, in 1 year, increase our contribution by about $900,000. And having to make that on an annual basis, but then not have the ability to fund it from one of my available sources of revenue, is a big problem. But the last point that needs to be mentioned here is taking away that local control isn't just something that is a inconvenience. It potentially can affect our bond rating. Our bond ratings are huge. Right now, the Village of Downers Grove has a AAA bond rating. We're very proud of that. But it isn't just a point of pride. Having that spectacular bond rating greatly lowers our debt costs. So when we go out, for example, and refinance some of our general obligation bonds, which we have for stormwater projects and other projects, we can save substantial amount of money, which benefits our constituents, leveraging our bond rating. Quick example, recently we refinanced a bunch of debt from earlier that was done back, I think, about 2007. We saved almost $1 million in interest costs on that, on those general obligation bonds because of our bond rating. You get that bond rating from a number of factors, obviously good financial management, but your flexibility and your ability to control your own destiny through flexible revenue sources is a key point for the bond rating agencies. So taking away some of that flexibility with a property tax freeze has a real-world impact upon communities and may ultimately cost our residents even more.
Now, things like bond ratings may sound like pretty dry talk on a Sunday, but I'll tell you, this is something that's very, very important because, you know, this is the cost of borrowing. It's basically what the interest rate is going to be on the loan. And why you should care is when you look at things like the Chicago Public Schools, who are, you know, to try to paper over their gaps, and you're looking at interest rates of over 8% based on the poor bond rating and the lack of ability to finance. So, very, very important topics. Palos Hills Mayor Jerry Bennett, Downers Grove Mayor Martin Tully. Gentlemen, thank you so much for joining me this morning on the Sunday Spin.
Rick, thanks. Been a pleasure to be here with you.
We'll be back with more right after this. Up ahead on the Sunday Spin, we're going to shift from property taxes into a nice segue of property taxes, state funding of our K through 12 education system with State Senator Andy Menar, Democrat from Bunker Hill.
Now back to the Tribune's Rick Pearson. It's the Sunday Spin on 720 WGN.
Good Sunday morning. Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson here in the Allstate Showcase Studio on this glorious, beautiful Sunday morning in downtown Chicago. You can follow us on Twitter at symbol Sunday Spin. I'm also at symbol Rap 30. And yesterday I kind of tweeted out a thought for the day, and this was from Bill Murray, comedian Bill Murray. Actually, a point to ponder here. This is what he tweeted. The fact that there's a highway to hell and only a stairway to heaven says a lot about anticipated traffic numbers. Think about that for just a moment, won't you? Well, joining me now on the studio hotline is State Senator Andy Menar, Democrat from Bunker Hill. Senator, thank you very much for joining me this morning.
Morning, Rick. Thanks for having me.
In the last half hour, we were talking with a couple of suburban mayors, and the conversation moved into the issue of those legislative efforts to freeze local property taxes. And they were pointing out that, you know, maybe if the state had funded education properly in the first place, the issue of property taxes wouldn't be as great as it is as in a political theater sort of way. And I know, and you were on recently, and I wanted to have you back on because this topic of state education funding, the state aid formula, just seems to be getting hotter and hotter with the concern that in the end we're going to have this budget impasse, and unlike last year, there isn't even going to be an appropriation for elementary and secondary schools. And what does that mean for schools opening this fall? Where do things stand right now?
Well, I'll tell you this, Rick. I don't see any movement to deny an appropriation bill for K through 12 education. You know, that word's been used by a lot of people. I don't see that at all. I see evidence to the contrary, and I would hope that continues. You know, much like we did last year, you know, we sent the governor, a couple dozen appropriation bills, which encompassed the entire state budget. He vetoed every one of those bills, with the exception of the K through 12 spending bill, despite the fact that every member in the legislature of his own party, every Republican in the legislature voted against that bill. He still signed it, which was, I think, a positive move on his part. So we've seen how we can get this done in the current fiscal year. So we at bare minimum could replicate that, you know, despite all of the challenges that we have going on. There's one area where we have found agreement with the governor. This year's a little bit different because, you know, that inequity that we've been working on for, you know, a couple of years now has gotten worse. And so there's many people such as myself and others across the state saying, well, we just can't do the same old thing this year. We can't let another year go by. That's why the Senate passed Senate Bill 231, which would change the way we distribute money. And I'm hoping that that conversation is going to continue during the final days of session.
Well, and of course, we've got the governor saying, well, no, don't change the school aid formula right now because that's just too complicated. It can't be done easily. And that he just wants a clean bill for school funding by itself, not part of a comprehensive state budget, or only if there's a comprehensive state budget agreement. But it, regardless, he wants just a clean funding bill under the current formula.
Yeah, the governor wants the status quo, which I think is ironic because I think we finally found something in state government that he likes, which is the way we fund schools today, which is universally dismissed as a good way to do business in state government. We have the least equitable system in the country. It is ripe for reform. It should have been reformed years ago, prior to even when I got to the legislature in 2013. So what we need today, I think, is leadership from the governor. So he brings his chair to the table, pulls his chair up to the table, and participates in this very difficult conversation. You know, he's avoided it so far, Rick, and that's disappointing because he's the one elected official in Springfield that is elected by the people of the state, statewide. You know, I represent the 48th district, which is the central part of the state, and I do my best to balance the needs of my district with the needs of the state, like every legislator does. But he's the one person, the one guy that was elected by the people of the state, and we need leadership from him on this issue. We haven't gotten it today.
So if the legislature were to go along and just, you know, do funding under this current formula, how does that play out for some of these school districts?
Well, we wouldn't do what the governor's proposing. You know, the governor should, I think, come to an understanding that what he has proposed back in February, which he has been traveling the state promoting, isn't going to happen. His proposal is not going to pass the legislature. And I don't control that, by the way, Rick. I'm just making an educated, view of how the world sits today in Springfield. There's even members of his own party have rejected it because it just simply makes the inequity worse. You know, the poorest school districts in the state get less money under the governor's proposal, which, by the way, is opposite of what the governor claims he wants to do. For example, you know, some of the take Chicago Public Schools, for example, just simply because it's the largest in the state. You know, by fully funding the foundation level, this foundation level that the governor trumpets across the state, by pouring $55 million more dollars into it, that earns Chicago Public Schools $78 million less. I'll say that one more time because it makes people's heads spin. By putting $55 million more into the formula today that the governor embraces, that earns Chicago Public Schools $78 million less. Now, you can take that and to a much lesser extent in terms of the numbers and apply it to the poorest school districts in the suburbs and those downstate, and they're scratching their heads saying, why in the world would Governor Rauner advocate for more spending during difficult budget times into a formula that everyone agrees, even he admits, is broken, that will earn the poorest school districts less money? Makes no sense. We have to have the more difficult conversation, which will require the governor pulling his chair to the table and being willing to have that tough conversation so that we can have a better outcome for our schools.
Can you, and there's nothing simple about this conversation of talking about the state school aid formula, and you of all people certainly know that because of the years you've spent in trying to, you know, form these discussions to the point of trying to advance some kind of legislation. And of course, that's not easy either. But how is it that you could put more money into the state school aid formula and schools would receive less money. Certain schools would receive less money.
Yeah, and you know, it's about, you know, there's about 860 in the state, and you know, I'm going off of a rough number here. You know, it's roughly 40%, a little bit less than half of the districts in the state would receive less money under the governor's proposal. And by the way, those are the districts with the highest property tax rates and the highest rates of poverty at the same time, which is a nasty mix for educators and for school boards. But here it is, Rick. We hit off of metrics and we hit off of benchmarks that existed in 1997 when the current formula was created in law. In a bipartisan way, in divided government in Springfield, Republican Senate, Republican governor, Democratic House, they came up with the current formula. It's in place today, almost in totality. And the world has changed, but we're still shelling out money the same way, which results in greater inequity, less money for poor districts, more money for wealthy districts. That is an upside-down equation, and one that has me left and hundreds of other superintendents left in the state scratching our heads as to why Governor Rauner would put his weight behind that.
But the governor, as he's been traveling and visiting various schools, says that it was the Democrats who changed the formula more recently, and that if schools are being punished, it's the Democratic majorities and the Democratic governorship that's their fault.
Well, he's just flat out wrong on that point. You know, facts are facts. And he's just incorrect. But let's just acknowledge, why does it matter? You know, if Democrats made it 20 years ago, I mean, I was in college, Rick, 20 years ago, just out of high school. And if Democrats
I was covering the General Assembly 20 years ago.
I mean, it's, you know, so if Democrats or Republicans or, you know, people from Mars put the current funding formula together, why does it matter? If Governor Rauner acknowledges that it's broken, which he does with his words, I would like to see him acknowledge it with his actions. It doesn't matter in the large scheme of things who put it together. What does matter is we have children living in poverty that are being punished by today's funding formula. I don't think they care too much who put it together, Democrats or Republicans. I think what they care about is, how do we fix it?
We're speaking with State Senator Andy Menard, Democrat from Bunker Hill down in Macoupin County. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin. Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson here in the Allstate Showcase Studio in Tribune Tower on lovely Michigan Avenue this morning. Joining me on the phone, State Senator Andy Menard, Democrat from Bunker Hill down in Macoupin County. Senator, you know... we've got the bill that it passed out of the Senate now to make these changes in the school aid formula, but we really don't know what the House is planning to do.
No, we don't. And, you know, with an issue of this size, Rick, I think it's only logical to acknowledge up front that the House should put its stamp on the bill. You know, I have to commend the House, both parties in the House, for having, you know, any number, I don't know how many in terms of a specific number, but incredible numbers of hours spent in public hearings going back to February on this issue. Very similar to what we did in the Senate in our bipartisan committee that led to this legislation. So, you know, I stopped by those hearings. I didn't testify, of course, because I'm a member of the Senate. But, you know, when I went in, members were engaged, both parties and from all parts of the state. Speaker Madigan was there, I think, on almost every occasion for the entirety of the hearings himself. And I think that helps lead us to a better place. But, you know, they do have to weigh in on the issue, and I fully expect them to.
It seems like they're the automatic response that we've seen to your legislation. And this is in not only comments made by Governor Rauner, but also, frankly, it's in kind of critical statements about Democratic legislative members by the state Republican Party, that your bill is a bailout of the Chicago Public Schools.
Well, you know, that's politics. I mean, that's just as, you know, as straight up political as you can get, you know, using an issue of great magnitude like this that that comes with a whole lot of political discussion, you know, as a parallel conversation. That's as political as you can make it, which is unfortunate. I think that's one reason why we haven't, as a state, been able to move forward in the last 20 years. But, you know, the bailout argument, Rick, is just another one that's just flat out untrue. You know, Chicago is the 105th greatest gainer of school districts in the state. So there's 104 school districts in Illinois that gain more money per pupil than Chicago. 58 of those are in the suburbs. 46 of those are downstate. And that shows balance to me. You know, there are struggling districts in the suburbs that have high tax rates, that don't have the values necessary, the property values necessary to generate the money that they need to run a school district. But Governor Rauner, you know, runs around downstate and points a finger of blame at Chicago and says, hey, downstate school district, we know you're struggling. And by the way, your problem is rooted in the Chicago public school system. That is the oldest play in the playbook. It is the oldest play in the playbook, and it's not helping the situation and doesn't get us closer to resolution.
I mean, certainly everybody knows about trying to play the regionalism game in downstate. And as I think you've even pointed out, here you are from Macoupin County, and this isn't necessarily, you know, a bill that gets you labeled as a hero if it helps Chicago.
No, it doesn't, because, you know, there's and I think this goes to the root and the depth of the problem that we face today. I think things have gotten so bad with funding public education, as evidenced by every report that you look at, that school districts are so desperate for change, they're willing to listen to anyone who talks about it, to the extent that even if it isn't true. You know, I'm not going to tell you, Rick, that this bill is going to solve every problem. It doesn't solve every problem. And we debated that in the Senate week before last. But what it does do is it turns the corner and it primes the system for more investment so that we can reduce reliance on property taxes, for example, so that we can bridge that gap of inequity, which is the greatest gap in the country today in Illinois, that is exercised on children that live in poverty. It's punitive. And so, you know, I get all kinds of accolades, I suppose. I get all kinds of criticism, depending on how someone interprets the bill. But at the end of the day, somebody's got to lead this conversation, and we have to bring it to resolution, which should be bipartisan between the legislature and the governor. That's what I'm committed to doing, but that's going to take Governor Rauner pulling his chair up to the table to have that difficult conversation.
As always, when we have conversations about the issue of school funding, and there's always the question that pops up, and I don't know about you, Senator, but it's also the question that I always get when I'm out, you know, talking with people, you know, whatever happened to the lotto money?
Yeah, that's I've done, I don't know how many town halls, Rick, over the past 2 years. I've lost count. The most recent was at Chavez Elementary on the south side. Typically, the first, second, or third question is the lottery money. And here's the answer. Lottery revenues are about 8% of what we spend on public education in the state of Illinois, which is much less than most people believe it to be. But of course, that's an important 8%. It does provide help. It does provide revenue to help equalize education and opportunity in the state. But it certainly isn't the answer that most people think it is. What we need to do is take that lottery money and spend it more effectively. We don't spend it effectively today, but we can do that. That's one thing that the bill that we've passed out of the Senate proposes.
And real quickly, Senator, there always is the issue of about consolidating the number of school districts in the state. And here again, this is also a very difficult thing, and it, particularly I think it's more difficult in rural areas of the state, because it's almost like, you know, these schools are the last identity in some of these communities.
Yeah, it is a difficult it's a difficult conversation to even have. You know, I live in a rural community in Macoupin County, and this is a tough one, but it's one that I think is met with the understanding that we have to give kids opportunity. And there's two types of consolidation, Rick, and one is typically focused on, which is, you know, two or three rural communities combining to make one school district. And my hesitation there is if you have three struggling school districts or two struggling school districts with finances, you're just going to get one larger struggling school district when you combine them. There will be efficiencies, and it does work. But then you also have the consolidation argument in many parts of the state that are not rural, where we have very small elementary districts that combine together, feed into a larger high school district. You know, that's one that typically never enters the consolidation conversation. But both, I think, are a necessary part of the conversation moving forward. Our bill doesn't contemplate any of that directly. But moving forward, I think we should account for those efficiencies that can then be translated into more opportunity for children. That's a tough one, but it's one that I think we have to have in the state.
State Senator Andy Menard, Democrat from Bunker Hill, thank you so much for joining me this morning on the Sunday Spin.
You bet. Thanks for having me, Rick.
We'll be back with more right after this. That's all we have time for on this week's edition of the Sunday Spin. I want to thank my guests, Pat Brady, Mayors Jerry Bennett from Palos Hills and Martin Tully from Downers Grove, and State Senator Andy Menard. And, of course, thank all of you for listening this morning. And a reminder that next Sunday we'll be coming to you live from the Illinois State Capitol for the never-ever-ending end of the legislative session. But
everything will be resolved. Everything in the state will be perfect. All problems will be fixed.
You make me laugh, sir.
Did I say that out loud?
You make me laugh. I'm the little dark rain cloud. I'm sorry. It's going to be some interesting times down there in Springfield, and I'll be there to bring them to you. And as a result,
is it going to get bloody?
It could. There could be fights. You know, it's more muddy.
Muddy
is what it is.
Muddy's a better
Yeah, exactly.
Bloody sounds a little
But as a result of...
As I said bloody, that sounds a little severe.
But because I'll be in Springfield, I will be missing your induction into the Walk of Fame.
And Rick, I think you need to rethink your priorities, sir.
And congratulations on the Silver Circle
as well. Yeah,
really
thanks.
Very nice.
Thanks. We had a nice night the other night. It's going to be a crazy time out in Pioneer Court, I think.
Well, look at all the honorees here, and
I know.
I mean, that's a very special thing, and my hat's off to you.
I appreciate that. I'm a little disturbed. You've heard some of these promotional announcements
that have been running,
profiling the people who are being inducted into the Walk of Fame this year. There's something a little disturbing about the ones that they've made for me.
Now, I can't say I've heard the ones about you.
No, they haven't been on the air yet.
Is that why?
We're gonna premiere those for you today.
Excellent.
A little disturbed about this.
Well, have a great show, and again, a great honor.
And enjoy Springfield.
You remember, I do it so you don't have to. Just keep that in mind.